You're listening to the Classic Gamers Guild podcast.
Hello and welcome back to the Classic Gamers Guild podcast. I am Rick, and I'm here with Anna this week, as well as a very special guest. But first things first, anything new with you this week, Anna?
I did a little bit of thrift shopping, and I came across some Space Quest and Police Quest collections at my local game store. So that's my excitement for this week, and that's enough for me.
That's something. Thrifting is something that a lot of people out there can't do these days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're pretty lucky on our little island over here. Thrift stores are still open, although, you know, with limited people in full masks and other protocols, of course.
We do also have that privilege, but there's just, like I said before, Ottawa just has nothing to be found at the thrift stores for us, for our kind. But anyways, that aside, without any further ado, we are very honored to have on our show this week a designer and contributor to many of the greatest adventure games of all time through his long tenure with Lucasfilm Games and LucasArts Entertainment, including the all-time classic Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis, the underdog cult classic The Dig, the iconic insult sword fighting in The Secret of Monkey Island, and one of my favorite combat flight sims ever, Their Finest Hour, The Battle of Britain. He has worked as a game designer with DreamWorks Interactive, the 3DO company, NF Interactive, and Google, and currently he is the owner of The Inspiracy Freelance Design and Senior Vice President of Content for Mind Maze, working on games to assist with stroke recovery and other health-based entertainment. Please welcome to our show the incomparable Noah Falstein.
Thank you very much, Rick. It's good to be here.
Thank you. I hope my information was accurate. There was a lot to work from, and to try to condense it down was quite a bit of chopping and picking and choosing. So I hope everything there was on the level.
It was almost. I should clarify that Mind Maze shut down their San Francisco office that the three of us who were making that up comprised back in February, just before the whole coronavirus thing hit. So that's a former, but not a problem. As a consultant, I'm working with half a dozen different companies at any given time. So they come and go.
Fair enough. According to our research, namely Wikipedia, you were one of the original people who work at Lucasfilm Games. So start us from the beginning. Where did you start in gaming? How did you get into it? And how did you get to Lucasfilm and eventually LucasArts?
Sure. Well, let's see. Without going back too far, because I think, when I look at inspirations, it probably goes back to playing board games as a very young kid. Mm-hmm. But for video games, it really began in college for me, which in my case, given my dinosaur status, was back in the late 1970s. And I went to a place called Hampshire College in Western Massachusetts that lets you design your own curriculum. And I had thought I was going to be an astronomy major, and I was very interested in the sciences in general. But my first semester there, I was taking a calculus course, and our professor strongly recommended that any of us wanting to do math should start to learn computers and programming. And in the computer class, we were introduced to text-based games. Actually, the big one was a text-based Star Trek game that I just fell in love with. Mm. And it was a real seminal moment for me. I ended up studying programming, but also doing a big independent project as my senior project that was an asteroid mining game using our only video terminal. Everything else up to that point had been text-based teletypes and stuff. So I was really getting in on the ground floor. And this one video terminal didn't do graphics, but I was able to put the text anywhere on the screen at will, and was able to animate and make the equivalent of spaceship displays and asteroids and stuff that way.
Oh, wow.
And from there, I basically graduated college and went straight into the video game industry, although at the time it didn't seem like an industry so much as just a lucky break. And worked at Milton Bradley for a while that is now part of Hasbro. And just about everything I worked on there got canceled before they released it, although I did have the distinction of advising my my boss that they should buy out a company called General Computer. They had a console called Vectrex that you may know of if you're up on your old game console stuff. And so I helped Milton Bradley acquire that.
Oh, cool.
And was at Milton Bradley for a few years. Then I went to Chicago and worked for Williams Electronics. And I was the project leader on a arcade game called Sinistar that had one of the earliest talking characters in it.
That's right.
And while I was at working on Sinistar, the whole coin-op industry started to have a collapse. This was in 82, 83, and over 90% of the sales went away, you know, within that year. And they basically laid off almost the entire group. And I had had a friend interview with what was then Lucasfilm Games. Actually, I don't think it even had a name at that point. It was just the games group that was part of the computer division. And she didn't get the job, but used me as a reference. And a few months later, when I was laid off, I called David Fox, who was the person who had interviewed me, and asked if they were, you know, hiring anymore. And it turns out the timing was good. And starting in early 1984, I became, depending on how you count it, I think I was either the seventh or eighth employee at Lucasfilm Games.
Wow. Yeah,
that's early on. Didn't you hire Ron Gilbert?
Yeah, actually, I think my impact is probably stronger from the people I hired than even what I did myself. And that, you know, it's just this whole chain. And I guess given that, I should give David Fox credit because he brought me in. But I hired Ron to work on a game called PHM Pegasus that I was working. Actually, no, wait a minute. Ron was actually on Coronis Rift originally. Larry Holland, who did our flight simulators that you alluded to, I hired to work on PHM Pegasus. And of course, Ron hired Dave Grossman and Tim Schafer for the Monkey Island games. And, you know, Tim on his own, of course, is a one-man legend. So, it's been a nice pedigree of people. That whole group of us who started at Lucasfilm Games, many of us are still close friends, and we kind of marvel at how lucky we were to be in such a critical spot at the right time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, Coronis Rift looks like an interesting game. Now, I haven't played it myself, but it looks like it's not just your typical kind of a sim game. What is it that makes that different from a regular arcade game?
Well, you know, I would say it was in some ways a proto first-person shooter, although we didn't realize it at the time. The special sauce we had for the first couple of games was a fractal engine that was able to do simulated, very crude 3D landscapes, but still being crude much better than any 3D landscapes that were also being done on the computers of the time. And that was because some of the ILM guys had really wonderful experience in doing that kind of assembly language programming to make that sort of thing possible. And Coronis Rift lets you drive this tank around an ancient battleground where a bunch of different races once fought wars, and you would, you know, shoot at these flying saucers that came to attack you, and you would pick up weapons from these ancient tanks and incorporate them into your own tank, and then move on, you know, level by level until you had the climactic boss battles, of course, and finish the game.
Yeah, it does look great. I mean, for 1985, I'm impressed. I'm looking at some screenshots here.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well, the Atari 800, that was where we started, was really, I think, ahead of its time. You know, had I forget whether it was 128 or 256 colors that were possible. I know the VCS that I also worked on, the Atari 2600, only had 128 colors. But at any rate, that was a huge number compared to, you know, from there we kind of graduated to the Commodore 64 with 16 colors, all ugly. So.
You actually mentioned a little bit that you were in the industry at the time when the video games kind of collapsed in the early 80s. If I'm not mistaken, that's sort of that's a time which generally has been regarded through the years as being attributed to the E.T. game. What do you think about that theory that E.T. the Atari game like basically crashed the industry.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, that wasn't true. I mean, it's basically one of those stories that sounds great, so I'm sure that's why it's gotten propagated. But you know, Howard Warshaw, who did that, has corrected the story a few times. Basically, what happened is the ET game got caught in the same problem that everybody else did, but that was sort of the highest profile casualty, I think. And so that often gets blamed. But really what happened is, you know, I got to see what was going on right from early stages, and that we went from around 80, 81, where this Atari VCS just took off and became, you know, the first really hugely successful game console out there. There had been a few others that had done okay, but that was the one that was just making huge amounts of money. And the first couple of companies, at first Atari tried to keep it to themselves, but several companies reverse engineered it. We reverse engineered it at Milton Bradley and managed to make several games that, as I said, were canceled before they released them. But other companies, like notably Activision, went off and made, you know, many millions of dollars on that sort of thing. But it was relatively easy for people to do that reverse engineering. And by 83 or so, there were so many companies making games, and they were trying to make them as quickly as they could. So the quality was going down, the number was going up. And you went sort of from one year to the next, there was about probably a tenfold increase in the number of games on the market. And many of the new games were just, you know, terrible sort of shovelware stuff that really should not have ever been published. And as a consequence, they weren't able to sell it. So instead of selling for $20, they dropped it to $10, $5, get five of them for, a dollar each, that sort of thing. And then, you know, when people are going to the store and they see a new high quality game for $20 or a pack of, you know, five for $5, and you can't really tell from the pictures on the screen, on the box, you know, whether it's good or not, they basically got the cheap games, hated them, and said, well, this sucks, I'm just not going to bother recommending this or playing more of these games. And I think E.T., you know, kind of got caught in that a bit as well, in that they were basically pushed to rush it out the door way too quickly. And it was a great license, but the game itself was just, for the amount of time that he spent doing it, it was amazing. But compared to the quality of some of the other, you know, high level games there, like the ones Activision was doing, it really just didn't compare.
Yeah.
Yeah, the general public have a bit of trouble putting things into perspective that way. I mean, because they wouldn't even know.
Of course. And meanwhile, the arcades were having a similar collapse. But in their case, I think it was more of a kind of a fad, and people thought this was a cool new thing. And once a lot of people started getting over that, they just weren't as excited about, you know, seeing whatever the new thing in the arcades was. But happily, about that same time, home computers were starting to take off, and that was actually growing, which was why the Lucasfilm move seemed like a good thing at the time.
Yeah, fair enough. So we got in contact with you shortly after we did an episode about Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis just about a month ago. So you've heard us talk about that, and you're probably aware now that is regarded as one of the greatest adventure games ever made by the fans. Were you aware of this legacy up until recently, or like, did you know that this is sort of how well regarded the game was?
Well, it's interesting. It certainly has grown in people's appreciation over the years, and I think a lot of it was that at the time, you know, at LucasArts, we knew we were really lucky to be where we were, and we felt like we were doing a good job. But you know, I've talked to my friends there, and none of us really, you know, were into making predictions. And you know, I think if anything, we would have all assumed that the games after a few years would be, if not forgotten, at least just, you know, relegated to nostalgia and probably unplayable, because, you know, when we were making those games, the first emulators had yet to be seen. And so there was this sense that after the computers were defunct, which was happening in just a few years, it would become increasingly hard to even find a machine to play them on. And, you know, we just didn't realize where things were going that way. But starting, I would say, by the end of the 1990s, around, you know, right around 2000, we started to get a sense that, you know, wow, there's a lot of people who started playing these games, you know, years after they were built. And then, you know, that was right around when the first emulators became popular. So they started playing them on computers that weren't even designed, you know, to play those original games. And over the years, we've gradually seen that kind of fall out and are incredibly grateful. You know, it's another interesting point, actually. We can delve into this if you like. But the LucasArts games were enormously popular in Europe in general and in Germany in particular, or I should say German-speaking countries. And I think per capita, I remember seeing the figures for Monkey Island 2 in particular, that on a per capita basis, it sold 10 times better in Germany than it did in the U.S. Really? And to this day, you know, I think the most rabid fans I meet are when I've been in Germany and Austria. And it's marvelous to hear the number of people that have said that they learned English just so they could play our games.
Yeah,
it's something that we do hear an awful lot. It's fantastic.
Yeah. Actually, usually the way I hear it is that your games taught people English, like, you know, just by playing it, which is a really cool, you know, that Scum engine of constructing the sentences. I could totally see how that would really facilitate that.
Yeah, although probably their grammar suffered from it at first.
Well, Sierra, even text games didn't always help. Open door. Go north.
Yeah. Use this on that.
Sentence development lacking, but still it teaches skills.
So did you come up with the story for Fate of Atlantis?
Well, Fate of Atlantis was very much a collaboration, you know, on the design side with Hal Barwood and I. Mm-hmm. And Hal is a master storyteller, and, you know, we became good friends in that and, you know, stay in close touch to today. He had a successful career as a screenwriter and producer and director, really good at dialogue in particular. And so I have to give him the lion's share of the credit for a lot of the story, although it's always been a strong interest of mine. I think all of us in those early days at LucasArts came to the company because we love storytelling. You know, we're very into the whole process. And when Hal came on board, he was an old friend of both George and George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, having gone to film school alongside them. And he wrote the screenplays for a couple of Spielberg's early movies. Actually, was the ghostwriter on Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and he worked with George on a bunch of stuff and was coming up to Skywalker Ranch where we were working, and loved video games. So he would come by and talk to us and shocked us all by suggesting that he thought he might quit being a filmmaker if we'd hire him as a game maker. And we, you know, we were just delighted for that. And as it happened, the timing was good for Fate of Atlantis, and they assigned me to work with him to be the game expert, to, you know, basically break him in on that. He had done games, but only on an amateur basis up to that. And so we collaborated on it. Certainly the theme itself and the story, and we were very much in sync of what we thought it should be, you know, and how it should feel. And we did research together and spent hours just bouncing ideas back and forth. But that was the real genesis of it. And as I say, when it comes to a lot of the dialogue, that was primarily Hal. When it comes to some of the interactive structure of the game, that was probably more my doing for a lot of that.
Oh, it all blended so well to just make a masterpiece of a game. And that's coming from, I mean, at least for me, I had been playing Sierra games from back in the early 80s, and I didn't come across LucasArts games until a little bit later. And it was just, as a girl, and I wasn't big into Indiana Jones at the time, my dad brought home this game and said, well, try it. I'm like, I'm not even sure if it's my kind of game, am I going to like it? And then, of course, I'm like, wow, this game is amazing. It is so well written. It is just so fun to play. And even the arcade sequences are fun. So
I'm delighted to hear that. One of the things that we agreed on is that we wanted, we wanted it to feel like the movies, but we really missed the feeling of Marion Ravenwood in the first movie, and we wanted a female foil for Indy, who was really his equal and not somebody who is just, eye candy, or, we weren't that crazy about what happened in the subsequent films. And as a consequence, we found we had a lot of women who enjoyed the game and who played the team path where you get to be Sophia. And, it really felt good to be reinforcing that in those days.
I didn't even know there was another path until I was a few years into some experience with the game. I'm like, why would you? What do you mean? You can actually choose not to? I assumed that was the only choice you had.
Well, that was actually by design. One of the things that I'm really proud of is that rather than being explicit and, you start the game and it says, this game has three paths, you can pick one or the other. Yeah. We basically tested you and then in the game confirm that the choice we think you make is feels good to you, but we do it all essentially kind of in character. I guess these days we call it diegetically. And if you do it right, you don't realize there are paths just like you do. You just end up getting steered onto the one that best suits you. And I should say, Luke Hassel over at Westwood Studios was a big fan of that, and with his Blade Runner game that came out a few years later, he took that to the next level, where the whole story changes. Whether Blade Runners are whether the replicants are evil robots or persecuted, proto humans, really depends on the choices you make in the game, and it reinforces whatever your prejudices are, which I thought was really brilliant. But he was, building on some of the stuff we had done there.
Yeah, it's another one which a lot of people really credit as being among the best point-and-click adventures of all time. And if the it makes sense if they were to take a lot of inspiration from Fate of Atlantis, for sure. One of the very, very common comments that are made in the classic gaming communities whenever Fate of Atlantis gets mentioned, and I assure you that's a lot, but there will always be at least multiple people who will throw in a comment saying that the Fate of Atlantis is the real fourth Indiana Jones movie.
A lot.
Yeah.
Well, we've been flattered by that. Yeah, I think a lot of that is due to Hal's track record as a screenwriter. He knows how to write stories that lend themselves well visually.
I mean, it's not wrong either, because whenever people point that out, I'm quick to actually point out that in the Lost Journal of Indiana Jones, there are actually a couple of pages that canonize and reference Fate of Atlantis in between Last Crusade and that other movie.
I don't feel the Indiana Jones stuff was a great privilege to work on that, but whether or not something becomes canon, that's really not as critical for me. It was just a chance to get to play in that wonderful area.
Now another big favorite amongst classic gamers is Loom, one which I rarely ever come across anyone who has anything even remotely negative to say about any aspect of that game. But I always forget, because I see your name referenced every now and then when the game is mentioned, but I can't really find a lot of information about your involvement. Were you involved in what capacity?
Well, one of the things that was wonderful about our community at Lucasfilm, particularly in the 4 years we were at Skywalker Ranch, is that we were all constantly, looking over each other's shoulders and saying, oh, why are you doing that? How about this? And among the people that I brought into the company was Brian Moriarty, who I had met at a conference in Silicon Valley and found out that he worked for Infocom. And I talked to him about how much we appreciated that and were inspired by it. And he said, oh, well, I really enjoy LucasArts. And, and I knew we were hiring, and I ventured to ask him, and it turned out the timing was great. And not only did he come on board, but we ended up sharing an office for a few years at Skywalker. And so while he was working on, trying to figure out what it is that he wanted to do next, we would have conversations. And I told him about an idea that I wanted to do someday that I still haven't had a chance to do, called The Science of Magic, where you could actually cast magical spells, but have it be part of the player's actual skill set, so that rather than, you know, sort of pick it from a menu, you would, you know, move the mouse, or, you know, I was working on different ways to have it be part of your actual skills. And if you did the skill thing wrong, then the spell could go awry and in mm-hmm. ways that were essentially predictable, or, you know, once you started to get used to it. So, and it was way beyond what could have been done then. I'm actually really interested in the thought of doing it using VR these days, because I think that would be a perfect place for it. But Brian thought that was a really interesting idea. And he later, you know, told me that that was the seed that kind of grew into Loom, though, of course, it went off in quite a different direction. And, you know, I got to see him working on that, you know, literally would just turn around and he'd be working on some scenes or concepts. And we all passed documents around to each other and helped each other out quite a bit. So I didn't have a really strong influence, but I know he thanked me in the credits. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was a real pleasure to be sharing the office and seeing the creativity he put into that.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about the day-to-day work operations at Lucasfilms. I mean, were you in a big open space? Was it individual offices? From what I recall, I think you guys worked in smaller groups than, say, a company like Sierra did later on.
Yeah, well, it changed quite a bit over the time I was there. You know, when I first started, we were in some windowless offices in one of the buildings where ILM was working. And we were in the group, we were part of the computer division that was part of ILM in turn. Well, actually part of Lucasfilm in turn, rather. And a big chunk of the computer division is what got spun off to be Pixar. So a lot of those folks were friends of ours. And, you know, even to this day, I still see familiar names. You know, now they're mostly management at Pixar, but there was a lot of close connection there. So that was sort of our earliest phase when we were in a bunch of small offices. Usually two people to an office, I think, was the norm. You know, so it wasn't quite that big, but not private for most of us. Mm-hmm. I think just one or two people got offices of their own. But when we moved a few years later out to Skywalker Ranch, we were the first ones to use the building there called the Stable Building. Mm-hmm. And Skywalker Ranch is just an amazing location. And George built it according to a storyboard. He basically came up with a fictional story about a sea captain in the 1880s who made a lot of money in New England and then came out to California. And, you know, he had a timeline of when each building was built over, you know, the last century. And then, of course, built everything brand new in the 1980s, but made it look like the buildings were made at different times, different purposes. And our building, what had been the stables, and we tried not to be offended by the fact that they stuck us in the place for the horses. But the architecture of the building turned out to be brilliant for our purposes, which was that you come into the building and it's a two-story building that is centered around a courtyard that has a big watering trough for the horses in the center, ostensibly for the horses. They've never actually been there. And then the two sides of the buildings to either end of that had a little lobby areas. And off of the lobby, you know, the lobbies had these beautiful fireplaces and big leather couches. And, you know, in the winters, you know, there are roaring fires there. And it meant that in either side, you would end up going through this lobby area and there are places to bump into people and hang out on the couches. And in the center, if you're going from one side of the building to another, the watering trough was there. And many, many times we would have a conversation that would start in one of these common areas and other people would walk by and hear what we're talking about and get involved. And, you know, sometimes these would last for hours. It was just great creativity and talking about ideas or problems or even just the latest, you know, TV episodes we had been watching and really liked. And I later heard that the Pixar buildings that I've seen out in Emeryville here were designed with a similar kind of structure where there are a lot of common areas and reasons mm-hmm. for people to cross back and forth. I see a lot of pedigree kind of going off from those early Lucasfilm days through Pixar, through what LucasArts branched off to, ILM XLab. We all have a similar kind of approach to things. And a lot of that comes through that sense of being highly collaborative and open, and sometimes even architecturally so.
I've heard tell that when things were open and people were communicate, there was a much bigger flow of creativity. And later on, when people started getting secretive and private about that sort of thing, and doors were closed and cross-company communication was halted, that it ended up stunting creativity for a while there. So it's nice to see that we're back opening things up again now and really thinking in the way that makes sense.
Yeah, sadly, I think that there aren't a lot of companies that are doing it that way, but, you know, there's a fair amount out there.
You mentioned early on that you started with board games. Do you still play board games?
I do. I mean, I have to say, in these, you know, coronavirus days, I have some friends who have managed to do some online versions of games, but I haven't done it much since then. And I have a lot of game designer friends who get together regularly. And, you know, it's one of my great loves is playing board games, not just with other game designers, but with some of my friends who are board game designers. And they will, you know, play test their versions with us. And game designers just love to argue about rules and concepts. And so we'll sometimes only get, you know, a quarter of the way through the game, but have so much fun talking about it. And the designer will be scratching stuff out on the cards or the rules or the game board and you know, wow, reconfiguring it even as we speak. So it's really fun to be part of the games when they're being made that way. But yeah, I do play board games, you know, certainly the quality of European games in particular has been amazing, and I've loved seeing the creativity and the different entire styles of games that are popular these days.
What makes a game that's popular different now from in the past, and why European games in particular?
Well, the European movement was kind of where a lot of the really interesting games have come from in the last few years, I think, and not to criticize any other part of the world, but you know, I'm just impressed that they've been able to do that. That, you know, call out a few that illustrate it. There's a game called Dixit that I believe came from France. Mm-hmm. That just it's really hard to describe. It's not like any other genre. It's very visual. It uses artwork as a core thing. And my wife is not a game player, but it's one of the very few games where you can be an expert game player or an absolute beginner, and it's reasonably well handicapped, so both of you can have a good time together. There's another, you know, series of games, basically the I forget the name of the genre now, but the collaborative games where everybody is working together to finish the game successfully.
Yeah, cooperative games, yeah.
That's right. Cooperative games, thank you. Yeah, I knew it wasn't collaborative. I was off there. And that in itself is, you know, that's a real breath of fresh air. That was, you know, and I have to say, you mentioned Loom and how you haven't heard anything bad about it. And the irony is when Loom came out, it was just excoriated by a lot of our public. That was an era, you know, at that point, games cost around $40, and that was a lot of money, you know, by inflation standards. I guess that's probably up around $100 today. And they basically demanded 20 to 40 hours of gameplay for that money.
It was a shorter game.
Yeah, and Loom was, if anything, it was kind of a proto-casual game, and had a few people who, it was very polarizing. There were some people who sent these letters in and just loved it. There's this grandmother in Las Vegas, I remember, who just gave us this wonderful love letter that we put up on the board of how much they thought it was great, and she just thought this new video game thing was not for her, but Loom was, you know, friendly and inviting, and the music was beautiful. And then, you know, almost the same week, I think we got a letter from somebody who just, it was this absolute hate letter, you know, which sadly is kind of the what we see on Reddit these days. But it was, you know, how could you do this? You know, I finished the game in only like, you know, 3 hours. You know, even my 14-year-old daughter finished it in that amount of time, and you know, went on to talk about how you know, how could you possibly charge so much for a game that was done so quickly. And scrawled in at the bottom of this letter was, "I'm the 14-year-old daughter, and you suck." It was, yeah, we thought it was actually, it amused us at the time, you know, just to see how we could get these totally polarized different reviews. But of course, it wasn't amusing that a lot of the sales records, you know, were similarly, you know, they were influenced by the people who disliked it, unfortunately. Our audience, our potential audience, wasn't playing games and didn't own computers. If, you know, that game had come out on an iPad, I think it would have been a great thing.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, tell me a little bit about what I've heard you call the recipe of game design. I'm curious as to, like, you said it's compared to cooking. I do a lot of cooking. I play a lot of games. So I think these are terms that really help me to understand what you're talking about.
Well, really just a perspective I've generated over the years, where I realized that a lot of what I do as a game designer is similar to what I've learned. You know, I'm not by any means a great chef, but I've learned a lot about cooking. And it's interesting that you asked that, because just this morning I was in a brainstorming session and I trotted out one of my favorite analogies there, which is that chance and randomness in a game is very much like spice in cooking. If there's absolute predictability in the game and no randomness at all, it can be kind of bland, or certainly only for people of a certain taste. And likewise, if you overdo it and the game has got randomness and chaos all through it, it's like dumping curry powder into a dish until nobody can stand it. But with just the right amount, it really makes it fresh and surprising and exciting. And that's just one simple example. I would say maybe even a better one is that as a game designer, we are a lot like chefs creating a recipe. But we have to understand technology. We have to know how the computers work, just like a good chef has to know how the ovens work and what their temperature tolerance is. And, you know, the sort of Alton Brown school of cooking, where you really need to know the science behind it all. But even Alton Brown has a real aesthetic aspect to it. And the plating and the visuals of what you prepare are important, just as they are in games. And there are genres of games, just like there are essentially genres of cooking. And some of those are more like the style, like, you know, Indian food or Italian food. Others are more like the technique of, you know, creating souffles, or, you know, the frying or broiling or grilling, you know, versus parboiling. And lots of different analogies there, you know, just in terms of the ways that games are made and the way that good cooking is made, even down to the fact that until you actually get it out there, you don't know whether people are going to like it or not.
Yeah, it's a very good point. Oh, Alton Brown, actually, he's my go-to guy. I've never met somebody who can describe a way to cook a souffle better. It comes out perfect every time. And I tell you, that science, and that's amazing.
Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned it at one point earlier about nerd culture, and it was something that we all embraced, you know, happily at LucasArts. Ron Gilbert once said, you know, any good game design discussion begins with a 20-minute talk about Star Trek. And I'm kind of amazed that over, you know, 40 years, that hasn't gone out of style. You could still be talking about the latest Star Trek series.
It's so true. But there's a certain consistency in the inconsistency of game design, right? I mean, there's always threads that run through everything connecting it all. But at the same time, you know, leaps and bounds, technology changes. I mean, you've watched technology change from punch cards to floppy disks to tablets and virtual reality. What do you see as the next step in the evolution of computers and gaming?
Well, you know, happily, it's kind of this branching tree. So there's not one thing, but many things. And, you know, you sort of take your pick that so many things that are huge now that were just dreams or you know, fantasies when I was young, you know, things like esports, for example, that keeps getting bigger and bigger and blowing my mind that it's becoming so popular. I would say, well, the areas that I've been spending most of my time with recently are VR, or actually, I guess, XR, where it's just kind of a catch-all for all of the different types of reality modification you can do, as well as games for health, games for medicine, games for training doctors. And both of those, I think, are growing quickly, and I'll give a nod to one of my main clients, Achille Interactive, that was formed largely by some ex-LucasArts people. It's how I got brought into it about 11 years ago. And they just this summer became the very first company to get an FDA clearance to have a game that on its own, you know, without any other type of treatment or therapy, treats a disorder, in this case, pediatric ADHD. So there are people right now having doctors prescribe this game to be played in order to treat ADHD. And the randomized controlled studies they've done have seen results comparable to Adderall or Ritalin and these other heavy-duty drugs that can have some really scary side effects. Mm-hmm. So I'm just, you know, super excited about the idea of a future in which, you know, certainly not everything, but a large number of neurological disorders in particular can be aided or treated or ameliorated through these very specialized health games.
Mm-hmm. I believe it because, you know, even going back as a kid, I always had trouble with school and with learning some things with English or with proper sentence structure. And really, it was the games that kept me in line, kept me enticed and interested in a way that no other media was able to, television or even books, which, I mean, I liked, but not the same way. So for it to be able to help people with problems like ADHD, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, interactivity is very powerful, and I've always been interested in the brain, and I get to work with a lot of neuroscientists these days, and it's been a kind of marriage made in heaven in that we as game designers have been fascinated by the way that people's brains work. You know, you can kind of experiment with yourself and see how you're learning new, you know, rules or behaviors in a game, and see things like, you know, the point at which you tend to put a game away is when there's nothing new to learn, because games are really learning machines on a lot of levels. Raph Koster has a great book called A Theory of Fun, and he and I came to very similar conclusions at the same time about how humans evolved to play games that I'm a strong believer in. And it really, I think, has grown into something, you know, where we as game designers learn a lot from the neuroscientists, but they love what we do because a lot of, you know, the kinds of things neuroscientists have learned to do in order to treat neurological problems involve a lot of repetitive exercises, basically mental exercises. And if you are a scientist, you say, oh, well, we'll put a cursor up on a dot up on the screen and move the cursor over it. Great. Now we're going to move the dot somewhere else, move the cursor over. Great. Let's repeat that for an hour. And after 5 minutes, people are so bored, they just don't want to do it anymore. But of course, that's exactly what you're doing in so many games. And if it's, you know, Missile Command or even, you know, something a lot more modern, suddenly that activity becomes a lot more interesting. And so, you know, we learn how the brain works from them. They get better adherence and people actually using these things from us. And, you know, it's really exciting to see all the, you know, there's literally dozens and dozens of ways that game developers and doctors and clinicians are working together these days.
Yeah, that's a whole new world. And I love that the only side effect is lack of sleep because you're so into like retraining your brain.
Yeah, well, I mean, to get that FDA clearance, they literally had to go through, you know, what are side effects. And the two most important ones were headaches and occasional frustration, which, of course, familiar to all of us.
Very much yeah. so.
And compared to, you know, the heavy-duty drugs, I mean, that's I don't want to sneeze at somebody getting a headache, but it's a whole lot better than, you know, developing tremors or digestive problems, that sort of thing.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, very much so. That's fascinating. Have you ever worked with anybody from the Sierra team? Did you ever connect up with them for any reason or have coffee with one of them in passing, whether Ken and Roberta Williams, Al Lowe, or anybody else out there?
So actually, I mean, it's a interesting story to bring that up. And you mentioned your interest in Sierra games. There was obviously a lot of intense rivalry there. But at a developer level, there were a lot of friendships and not so much with Ken and Roberta. I've got a story about them that I'll give to you separately. But the nice thing is that today, well, so several of my old time game developer friends and I put together a workshop that we've been running for 20 years with fellow game designers. These are people like Bob Bates, who worked at Legend Entertainment, ran Legend Entertainment. Steve Moretzky, who was at Infocom and you know, worked on many games.
So many.
And then Gordon Walton came into the group, and Gordon has you look him up on Moby Games, and he's got this amazing list of games he's produced and early on designed. And we basically have this group that meets annually for discussions about story and character in gameplay. And as a consequence, a lot of the early people that got into this were LucasArts and Sierra people. And so quite a few of them, Christy Marks, I would say, has become a friend. Mm. Al Lowe has been to a number of our conferences. Laurie and Corey Cole are frequent attendees, and we all get together and brainstorm and really enjoy being with each other. But the corporate competition, you know, Sierra was doing much better than we were in the U.S. We were doing much better than them in Europe. And, you know, it was, you know, always the sense of rivalry of, can we top them? Mm-hmm. And there was one incident that I have to admit to a little schadenfreude, and that we kept wanting to scoop them if we could. And when I was working on Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the movie had not been come out yet, and we knew what it was about internally. We'd been working with the script, and a few weeks before the movie was premiered to the public, we had a special showing at the Stag Theater at Skywalker Ranch, this beautiful Art Deco theater there. And we got to invite a lot of other game people because we were showing off our game based on the new movie. And all that any of these people knew was that it was called The Last Crusade. They didn't know what it was about. And Ken and Roberta showed up, and, you know, they saw the movie, and then we had the game out in the lobby afterwards, and they could play the game a little bit. And I could see that they were really upset about something. And I couldn't quite figure out why they looked so sour afterwards until I realized, you know, the following year, that here was a game about going for the Holy Grail. And they were still 6 months away from releasing the Quest for the Grail game that they had.
Oh.
And so we were scooping them on, you know, when they said, oh, this is a cool game, an adventure game about seeking the Holy Grail. Immediately, of course, everybody was thinking about Indiana Jones. And, you know, so it was one of the few times where I felt that at least we got a leg up on them. And I think in terms of sales, we probably didn't beat the King's Quest games, but because of the movie, The Last Crusade was at that time the best-selling adventure game that we did. Although I'm happy to say also Fate of Atlantis, I think, was the all-time champion, you know, in terms of numbers sold.
I never put the two together in the timeline like that, because I never really thought to compare the two.
Well, I mean, in reality,
they're both such great games, but
The reality was, of course, they were very different games. You know, it didn't have that
feel. Of course.
Although, ironically, when Hal and I were looking at a topic for the this fourth game we were going to do, A Fate of Atlantis, we kind of came down to Atlantis or King Arthur's Sword Excalibur as being, you know, both of them about the same level of being very well known by at least Western audiences. And so that would have gotten us onto some similar ground there, you know, sort of after the Grail game had come out. But we decided that if it was about Excalibur, it'd be kind of hard to get Indy to go many places beyond England, and we really wanted that sort of globe-hopping feel that the movies had.
Mm, definitely did. Yeah, and I mean, the amount of time you had to wait for things to load sometimes back then, it really felt like you were traveling a distance.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, you mentioned, this is back when we were emailing with you, that you had found some interesting items when you were digging around recently. Anything that you want to talk about?
Sure. Well, I've talked about how collaborative things were, and usually the way we collaborated at Lucasfilm was that we would print out a concept document, sometimes we often call them one pagers, although they usually started with one simple page and ran to, you know, maybe as many as 20 or 30, depending on how far along the game got. And we would float these around and pass them on to people. And Eric Wilmunder and I think, are the two pack rats, and he's actually published some of these. I had them in a box in my garage, and the whole coronavirus thing meant that I suddenly had time to finally go through a lot of the boxes in the garage. So I found I have 1,700 pages of documents. And some of those are duplicates, like, you know, three or four different phases of Loom, for example, are in there. But it was really fun for me seeing that. And in particular, the large number, you know, for every game that we made, there were probably at least five or six concepts that were floated around as design docs, some of which actually got pretty far along as game concepts. You know, just speaking of Loom, the sequel Forge was planned out and actually had quite a bit of work done on it before that got canceled. And it, really? It was wow. really fun for me seeing this and seeing, you know, all sorts of old games, seeing, I think recently there was a version published of one of the docs that I had of, you know, that Ron Gilbert had held on to called Mutiny on Monkey Island, which was the original concept that became The Secret of Monkey Island. And it's fun, you know, getting to see these early stages and seeing what stuff was similar, what stuff was different. And I was the first project leader on The Dig. We actually had four project leaders, and it was 6 years in development and, you know, went through huge changes. But it was great pulling up a lot of these old docs. And I also, it prompted me to find some of the images and things I'd put on the computers by pulling out some old hard drives and restoring things. And it's just really fun to see how that stuff has changed. And, you know, there are a number of museums or collections now at universities. And, you know, where some of us have handed stuff off. I obviously have it in my garage mostly, but it's my intention to pass this stuff on. And I know there's a lot of interest. I'm just cautious not to release the stuff that other people have done, you know, without clearing it with them first.
Well, you worked with, didn't you work with Steven Spielberg as well as George Lucas on The Dig? Does that mean that some of it's their intellectual property as well, or how does that work?
Well, I don't even want to get into that on the record. I'm willing to say this much, that when we were at LucasArts, we were, there was kind of this corporate level game of spot the copyright infringement. And if you found people who were, you know, using one of our properties to sell their product, you know, very often it would be like, you know, the adventure in luggage, you know, has come to you. And then if you were the first one to report it to our licensing department, sometimes you would get, you know, a free set of luggage as a reward for that. And we used to take pride in the fact that we'd say our lawyers are the toughest in the business, except for Disney's. You know, hands down, Disney's were the hardest. And when LucasArts got acquired by Disney, I remember joking with my friends that, boy, if it was bad enough before, the new Disney legal team has got to be the scariest one out there. And having said that, I think I'll leave it at that as to why I don't want to get into any you know, ownership or IP things. But yes, I did have the pleasure of working, you know, running brainstorming sessions that both George and Steven were members of. And that was certainly a highlight of my career to work with such great guys and to get to steer them in brainstorming sessions. It was just delightful.
Yeah, that's an amazing trio. Boy, to have been a fly on that wall. I mean, my gosh, you guys.
Oh, it was great. And then I went on to DreamWorks Interactive, and it was largely because Steven was, you know, George is not a video game player, never really was, but believed in what we were doing and financed it. Steven is just, he's been a game addict, you know, all his adult life, basically. And it was just really wonderful to see. In fact, Rick, you alluded to Their Finest Hour, and he loved those World War II flight sims, you know, not surprising when you see all the World War II films he's done. But he played those games incessantly. And when I was working on The Dig, I got to meet with him at his home office in the Pacific Palisades. And there were three books on the desk there. One of them was, what's the name of the movie? Schindler's List, the original novel. Another one was another book that he turned into a film. But the book on top of the pile that was well thumbed and the cover was actually dog-eared and stuff was the manual to The Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe. And it just made me feel really good to see that was his go-to game there.
Well, those manuals, I mean, all the box contents, I mean, I have their finest hour. The box contents are gorgeous, and I mean, so well put together, and the manual is so thick and beefy and beautiful. I mean, that was such a good day of gaming.
Well, here's a bit of trivia. So Larry Holland, who was the main developer, and Larry is yet another one of those people I brought into the company, but we worked really closely on the first flight sims, and then I had a minor role on things like the X-Wing game that he did. Mm-hmm. But he and I got invited to the Churchill Seminar, the Churchill. It was basically a Winston Churchill fan club meeting in San Francisco of a bunch of people, most of them much older than us, who had heard about their finest hour of the game and wanted us to give a demo and talk about how this new medium of video games was dealing with this. And what was really amusing to us is that a lot of these people didn't own computers that would run the game, but they were buying copies of the game so they could have the manual because we had put so much time into researching the manual and took a lot of pride in illustrating not just, the people involved, but the technology involved and, charts about, the utilization of resources and, strategic decisions that were made. And, I had a wonderful time working with Larry on the research and the manuals for those games. Mm-hmm.
It really is a lost art to have like the big thick manuals. I know since in recent years, since I've started collecting vintage big box PC games, largely rebuilding my old collection from the games I had as a youth. But a lot of my choices for what to procure are definitely based on which ones had the coolest manuals. Definitely a really big part of, again, like I've said before, Their Finest Hour happens to be one of my favorite flight sims of all time. But that manual is just like, that is so cool. Like just that big, thick binder.
Yeah, I think, by the third game, we were up to over 200 pages. It was, a significant cost of goods problem, actually, because we made such a big manual. But as you and many other people found, people really appreciated the quality there. And it helped with piracy because you didn't get the manual if you pirated the software.
Well, and I mean, here we are bored in social studies class going, oh, man, I don't want to learn about all this technical stuff. And then we go home and we're poring over these manuals, all this detail, and we're learning all about it. So, I mean, hey, it was good for us.
Yeah, another one of my pet concepts is to start treating history from a video game perspective. And it's not a brand new idea, but the thing I would like to try is to use social media and imagine that, Twitter and Facebook and these sort of things were around during the, American Revolution, for example, and the kind of, things that King George would post about George Washington. And, I think that there is a way, much like Hamilton, actually, where through sort of making it into entertainment, you could actually teach quite a bit of real information that way. Certainly my daughter learned a huge amount from playing Civilization, I know, and I was very proud of the fact that she was coming home sometimes and saying she was able to answer questions in social studies because of stuff she'd learned through Civilization.
Funny enough, my 10-year-old is playing, Civilization, Panzer General, Heroes of Might and Magic, but all of that, since he was about 3 or 4 years old before he could even read, he was playing those games with us. And now, of course, that he's older, we can play hot seat with him, and he's some real competition, for us, not just for the computer. So it's really good for them.
Oh, absolutely. The whole slander really about games being bad for kids or detracting from them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's been so many studies now, particularly debunking the whole games causing violence thing. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the reasons why I'm so proud of the Games for Health, because when I, even to this day, I'll occasionally get people who hear that I make video games and, you know, will sneer or make some disparaging comment about how it's, you know, ruining their kids' lives or whatever. And it's really nice to be able to say that I've worked on a game that, you know, for example, helped kids who had leukemia stick with their chemotherapy regimen and, you know, just mm-hmm. the things where, you know, it's nice to watch mm-hmm. their faces when they realize, oh, I guess all games aren't the same and maybe I should think twice about whether they're good for you or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, the fact that games mm-hmm. make times pass has helped a lot of people get through some really hard times, not just here during these times, but like you said, in the hospital, dealing with long medical procedures, dealing with dialysis. I mean, it's a long time of sitting and doing nothing. And if you have something that's interactive, it occupies your mind better. Sometimes you can't concentrate on a book, or you don't just want to watch a TV show. You want to get involved in a situation, and gaming is there for you.
Well, these days, I hate exercise, and but I discovered years ago this sort of happy confluence. You know, I hate exercise, and occasionally I'll get really, you know, hooked on a game, actually more than occasionally. And I finally thought to put it together, and my go-to game has been Advance Wars on the Nintendo DS that I have literally put thousands and thousands of hours into, because I'll use it on a recumbent bike, and with the virus, I ended up, you know, getting a inexpensive bike for my home, and I didn't need one with a big display because I ignored that anyway and just had the DS in my hands. And if I'm playing that game, I can literally quadruple the number of calories that I burn. I knew I was onto something the first time I tried it, and when I finished my session, I got up off the bike and I almost fell down because my legs were so rubbery. But, yeah, you know, your body starts sending signals to your brain saying, hey, I'm getting kind of tired here. And your brain says, screw that. We're being invaded. You know, we need to build some rockets. This is much more important.
All right. So just before we start wrapping this up, I have a couple of questions from the listener mailbag. Not very many, but I think some very interesting questions posed by the community here. First one comes from Steve Coop of the Classic Gamers Guild Facebook group. And he asks, what was your favorite game that you worked on and why?
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, favorite game that I worked on, let me answer that in two ways. I guess my favorite game that I worked on in terms of feeling like it was most proud of would probably be Fate of Atlantis. I think, mm-hmm. you know, you've been very, you know, generous in your praise there. It was also a really fun game for me to work on, collaborating with Hal, and the three paths that we did was really my main contribution, I think. And it made the game more complicated, and Hal, who was the project leader, ended up having to do a lot more work because of that. And all through that, he kept saying, wow, are you sure we need to do this? And, you know, it eventually got committed and went and did it. And it was so gratifying to me that I think literally every review that came out singled out the three paths as one of their favorite things about the game. Mm-hmm. And that made me feel much better about having subjected Hal to all this work. So it was kind of great in that I enjoyed working with him. We've collaborated many times since then, even after leaving LucasArts. And you know, it was nice on that level. The one that I actually enjoyed playing the most would be Secret Weapons of the Luftwaffe. Mm-hmm. And I did a little bit of, I think I'm credited for their Q&A testing at that. And it's not unrelated. The fact is, whenever you work on a game, you know, and it's your main project, you just get so tired of it, or at least I do, and I know a lot of my friends do by the end, that, you know, it's sort of like these actors that tell you they've never actually seen themselves in a theater, you know, in a particular movie, because they just, once they're done shooting it, they don't want to even go back to it. And I won't say it gets to that point, but I certainly do get pretty sick and tired of games. But I love the flight simulators, and because I only had a very minor role, I didn't really work on it enough to get sick of it. And so playing it was always just a joy to me. And, you know, that particular game, the third of our trilogy of World War II flight sims, has some of the best strategy in it, I think, you know, in particular the answers questions in a very interactive and deep way about what would have happened if Germany had tried to do heavy duty production of jet aircraft. Their first test flight of a jet aircraft was in 1939, as the war was just starting. But they thought that by 41, 42, they were going to have the war wrapped up and have taken over the world. And they knew that their first production, you know, jet would just come out around 42. So they didn't bother. And by the time they changed their minds and started working on it, it came out too late to really have a major impact. And I loved the way that the game let you explore that. But it was just, you know, a kick-ass fun game to be flying a jet fighter around, you know, through a bunch of bomber formations, or to switch sides and see the tactics you needed, you know, in a P-51 to actually take on something that could go 100 miles an hour faster than you.
This next question comes from Sean McCauley, again, of the Classic Gamers Guild. Noah, you helped design Indy in The Last Crusade and Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis. They're alike in many ways, such as the decision to let players complete them differently. But the difficulty seems very different, with Crusade being seemingly much harder than Atlantis. Do you agree with that? And if Crusade were harder than Atlantis, would that be because it was 89 and not 92, and games were just harder early on, or because you dialed Atlantis into a larger audience?
I have to say that is a really well-composed question. First, because I was the only designer who worked on both of those games. And the biggest contribution I think I made was something I've done in other games as well, where I believe that it's a good idea to use the interactivity of the game to adapt to the player's preferences and have the game basically morph itself into the game that that player most likes. And that is exactly what he put his finger on as being a commonality between those two. With the three paths in Atlantis, it was really a more polished version of what I was experimenting with Ron and David on Last Crusade. And as to the difficulty, he also, I think, is correct in that by 92, we got the feeling that we could make games a little bit easier. But I think also what was going into effect there is that we were getting better at being tricky about it. And one of the reasons that we had three paths was that we wanted it to be different things to different players. Obviously, the different paths are different, but some players insisted on playing every path, and we put in, you know, which was another one of my ideas, was this indie quotient, which was scoring points for the puzzles you solve, but it's impossible to get all the points for just one path. A lot of the points were on different paths. And even on a given path, you might have to play through two or three times to be able to go through all the variants of puzzle solving that would give you every last point. And that was because there was a small but very vocal minority of players who were the completists, who if you did not give them their 40 hours, they'd get upset. And I mentioned that being, you know, the problem for Loom. Well, this is a way to make them happy, because they could play the game over and over multiple times, get different things out of it, get every last point. But the people who just wanted a good experience and to be able to actually get to the end of a game, they were able to pick have picked for them the one path that was most intuitive and easiest for them. And I didn't know quite how to do that with Last Crusade. And also, Last Crusade was more of a rush job. We were really pushing to get that game out while the movie was still in the theaters. And we did succeed at that. And I think it was only about 9 months from start to finish for that game, which was a record for us.
Holy cow.
But Ron Gilbert, David Fox, and I think it was also the only time we've had three project leaders co-project leading, which sounds like a recipe for disaster, but the three of us were so well aligned and enjoyed debating, you know, choices among us that we hardly ever had a problem. And almost always it was pretty clear which among us who would solve a given problem or work on a specific room or character or dialogue or technical issue. Anyway, long way to answer that, but I think that we were obligated to make the game a little tougher. I still feel a little bad about some of the mazes in that game, like in the catacombs and the Zeppelin. Yeah. But mazes are, you know, this is one of the tricks of the trade. And to talk about, you know, go back to the earlier cooking analogy, this is like when the chefs talk about when they have too much business and they cut corners and add a little more sugar or something to keep people happy. Mazes have the best return, you know, in terms of hours of play for versus hours of development. It's pretty easy to make a maze and it can take many hours to actually solve it. And yes. Yet it's not a whole lot of fun in a lot of cases. That, you know, yes. I do think having a maze where you're being chased by bad guys is much more fun than a maze where you're just trying to find your way out. So that's at least something that I insisted on, you know, in both of those games. You know, our mazes always have somebody chasing you. So it becomes an action thing and not just a you know, like in a lot of the old text adventures where it's, you know, keeping track and making a little paper copy of your maze. So that was really what was going on with those two games and why they changed.
This our last question. I think you've already kind of touched on. I'm not sure if you have anything else to expand on it. But Jess Lai of the Classic Gamers Guild, the Facebook group, asked, I started playing Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade before I watched the movie, and I used the movie as a bit of a hint guide to the game. How hard was it to design the game to be as close to the movie as possible?
Yeah, that was an interesting one, and they didn't give us much. They gave us an early shooting script for the movie and some still pictures, which were really not very helpful. And we didn't actually get to see the movie until about 3 weeks before it hit the theaters, at which point we found out that a whole bunch of the scenes that we had incorporated from the script into the game had been cut from the final film. There was a very interesting thing. I remember panicking at first and then having some discussions and using marketing thinking to basically turn it into, it's not a bug, it's a feature. So the back of the box, I think, talks about includes special features, you know, cut from the film, not even seen by the public.
Perfect.
And, you know, in reality, we had already decided. The hard thing we did that I'm pretty proud of the solution, because there have been a lot of games that were just, they were based on films that essentially just recapped what happened in the movie. And it's boring because you know how it turns out. And in particular, in an adventure game, if the movie gives away everything, then we knew that most of the people who played the game would have seen the movie already. And we didn't want to make the game totally different than the movie, because that's why they bought it. But if it was just like the movie, then it would be too easy to solve. And so that's why we made the game. A lot of the puzzles and action in the game are kind of the interstices of the scenes between what happened in the movie, you know, or giving us our imagination free rein in areas that were only glossed over by the film. And that, I think, worked quite well to reach this middle ground I talked of. And it also meant very fortuitously that it was okay that we had scenes from the movie that didn't, in the game that didn't get into the movie. In particular, I remember there's a scene in the game where you are on the Zeppelin and you have to subdue the radio operator and break the radio. Mm-hmm. That was an actual scene in the movie. And there's one tiny reference to it left in the actual film, that when Harrison Ford and Sean Connery get into the biplane from the Zeppelin, his father is bugging him about, you know, why do we have to do this? Why are you rushing me? He says, I thought it would take him longer to fix the radio, which makes no sense all in the context of the movie. But if you play the game, you know exactly why it was there.
That's awesome. A little in-joke nod, pretty much.
Okay, so I guess that's about all the time we have. But thank you so very much for taking the time to chat with us. Just before we call it a wrap, is there anything else you would like to throw in there? Any shout-outs or plugs or any just sort of anything you'd like to get out?
Oh, I don't think so. I guess I should. One of the things we did with all of our games at LucasArts was special thanks to George Lucas and with the day getting Steven Spielberg. And I guess I should, you know, tip my hat to him one more time, just telling you about this and thinking about it. Is one of the things I really appreciate is how he had the foresight to realize that, you know, video games had a future, even though he wasn't a big fan of them himself. And, you know, I am forever grateful, as obviously a lot of game fans are, that he went through the trouble of creating that games group and fostering it to the point that it became the success that it did. So I'll thank George one more time.
Of course. Well, again, thank you so very much. It's been a great honor and pleasure to get to talk to you. There's a lot of, a lot of really great stories to hear that I wasn't really aware of before. So it's, it's been a great little history lesson on some of my favorite games. Thank you so much for joining us, Noah. I hope, maybe we'll be able to get you on again sometime soon as well.
Thank you both. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you very much. And to all of our listeners out there, thank you for joining us. As you know, we are a community on Facebook. We have a page and a group. We are on Twitter at the CG Guild. We are on Instagram at CGG Podcast. You can send us any questions or comments or hate mail at mail@classicgamersguild.com. If you'd like to support the show, we are on Patreon. And, we don't do much with that, but you do definitely support us, and we are very appreciative, especially to our special thanks tier. That would be Mark Fillion and Jay Holmes. Thank you guys so much for your contributions. It really helps keep the lights on around here. Thank you all very much for joining us, and don't do a murder.